I think people love forums. I think they like to be on forums. I think that people realize more than ever that we're all dopamine addicts, that we've all been accustomed to living in a bubble of air conditioning and heater. You know, no bugs are biting us, no snakes are after us. And I think a lot of people, you know, like in the movie The Matrix, it's like they're seeing through it for the first time. They know that they want to interact with the natural landform. They know that they want to be a part of where their food comes from and know where their food comes from. And so the idea would be, hey, we'll take the 700 acres, we'll develop in small villages, you know, 25 cabins here, 25 cabins here, all in different settings. And then the people that live in those cabins will all collectively own the farm. And all you have to do is pay your monthly fee and you can get your hands dirty. You don't have to get your hands dirty. You can go, you know, pick up your eggs or not. I mean, it's all completely up to you.
Welcome to the Regenerative Real Estate Podcast, a show about human environments and how they can be used as a force for good. Conversations that educate and inspire people looking for a different way to do real estate. I'm Neil Collins, and on this episode, I'm joined by Douglas Davis, the visionary developer behind the farm at Okefenokee, a sustainable community integrated into a 705-acre regenerative farm located on the border of northern Florida. I recently learned that the first golf course community ever built was in the 1920s at a place called Temple Terrace, located near Tampa, Florida. Built on top of the largest citrus grove in the world, the vision for the community was that wealthy retired northerners who enjoyed the game of golf would purchase lots, build Mediterranean revival villas, and spend their winters in Florida playing rounds of golf and dining at the clubhouse. Funny enough, there was even an additional bonus for homeowners who wanted to buy a subdivided parcel in the remaining citrus grove where they could become hobby citrus farmers. After that, master planned communities situated around golf courses sprung up across the world, promoted by developers who would sell lots at premiums, which would then subsidize the operating costs of the golf courses. It's reported that nearly 60% of all golf courses built in the 1990s were integrated into a master planned community. Now, I don't fancy myself much as a golfer, so maybe I'm not the best target market for this kind of a community. But what I do get excited about is the thought of a neighborhood planned around a farm that provides residents with opportunities to indulge in the fruits of the land and have a relationship with the farm and the farmers in a way that we simply can't whenever we rely upon a grocery store for all our provisions. It seems like I'm not the only person that fantasizes about this notion of an agrihood. In fact, our guest today, Doug Davis, shares a similar story where before he ever learned about regenerative agriculture, he envisioned a community of homes with porches opening onto bucolic fields of corn, cows, and beans. Fortunately, before that came to pass, he stumbled upon a book by Michael Pollan that helped open his eyes to the type of agriculture that produces food that nourishes our bodies and regenerates the land. Doug has a fascinating story growing up close to the land that has inspired him to follow a career into real estate development that has been underpinned by conservation. I originally came across the farm at Okefenokee online and knew immediately that this was a place that I wanted to learn more about. You are in for a real treat today as Doug talks about the vision for the property and how he has gone about developing an agrihood situated on rolling hills and pastures, connected by trails, adjacent to the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge, and, of course, immersed in nature. Before jumping into the interview, I want to say that it's a real pleasure to produce the Regenerative Real Estate Podcast. Over the past several years, we've had over 100 people join us on the show that are leading the way of how we are designing, building, managing, and stewarding communities. We've explored topics from regenerative agriculture to transformative finance, and we hope that we can produce another 100 episodes that share more stories from industry pioneers and the culture-changing projects that they are involved in. If you are finding value from these episodes, I'd appreciate it if you would leave a rating or review of the show. I can tell you that there is no compliment more value than when you share the podcast with your friends and colleagues that may need to hear it. So thank you to everyone who has left a review and for taking the time to support the show. Now, let's get into it with Doug Davis from The Farm at Okefenokee. Doug, it is a pleasure to have you. I think you said this before, your first podcast appearance. So welcome to the Regenerative Real Estate Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Doug, one of the things that really prompted me reaching out was I look at a lot of people within this regenerative development, regenerative agriculture space, and it really seems like you are walking the walk, talking the talk, and really getting your hands dirty, because I came across The Farm at Okefenokee, if I'm saying that right.
You are. You are, yeah.
And not only is it really forward on the regenerative agriculture side, but it's around this theme of community and sustainability and resilience that we really jam on the podcast. And it was like, how have I not heard of this of this guy, Doug Davis, and in this project on the border of Georgia and Florida? So it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I can't wait to really get into that project. But I really want to back up and learn a little bit more about you as a person, where you grew up. It looks like you've been in a professional land developer, but I don't want to put words to a title that you don't agree with. So why don't I throw it to you and we can start there?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you for asking that question, because part of my excitement about doing what I'm doing today is really has been building, right? I mean, any great climax doesn't immediately happen. And so when I look back, what seems to be many years of valleys and many years of kind of wondering what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, it's fun now to look back and see that all of those things were preparing me to be where I'm at today. And so, yeah, so growing up, I'm from North Florida, grew up in Jacksonville, the greater Jacksonville area, south of Jacksonville for the most part. As a kid growing up, I had a great time. I grew up in the 80s. It was back before cell phones. So I would, both my parents worked. So when I got out of school, the world was a blank canvas for me. And we would go outside and we would play and all day long until it got dark at night. And so, some of the earliest memories I have is just exploring the woods and building tree forts and trying to, as we thought at the time, live off the land. We would make rafts out of old logs and catch brim and try to cook them on an open fire. And just, it was kind of the Huckleberry Finn type mentality. And as a kid, that's just, my passions have always been around the idea of exploration. I have to be honest, I'm a little bit of a adrenaline junkie. So also growing up, I loved extreme things. I skateboarded, I surfed, I hunted, I fished. I backpacked, I through hiked, anything that would get me out on the water or in the woods, my hands in the dirt, my hands in the water, and fending for myself has always just been a passion of mine. And to this very day, it's still one of the ways that I ground myself is just being out in nature. I just absolutely love it. So those were kind of some of the hallmarks that would signify my youth. Now, the bad part is, with some of those tendencies of being left to wonder, being extreme, I also became a little bit of a hellion. So I was a hellion, but again, it's part of my story. And so I share with people that don't despair, don't give up, just keep pressing forward. But So as I was going through junior high and high school, the amount of time I spent in school was plummeting. The amount of time that I was spending in the water fishing and wade fishing and surfing and everything else was increasing. And by the time I graduated, college was really not an option for me. So I started construction. My father told me that I could either move out of the house, or he would give me some time to figure things out as long as I was working meaningfully. So he gave me his old tool belt. He was a carpenter. And he said, "Hey, I want you to go get a job working construction." And so that was really, you know, coupled with kind of my background, that was the birthplace of this idea of building things and the idea of being a part of something, fabricating something. And so I really fell in love with the construction industry and really enjoyed what I was doing. But the downside to the construction industry, especially in North Florida, is during the summertime, it gets really, really hot. It's a tough life. I was really worn out. I was getting tired, and I had a really, really neat experience happen. And it was a pivotal point for me. I was working at the Baptist Hospital in downtown Jacksonville, and we were ripping out the old emergency room, and we were rebuilding it, putting in the walls and the ceilings and everything else. And we had like 3 days where we had worked nonstop because we had a big inspection with like HRS coming in. And I was just worn out. I was laying on a gang box, probably slept there the last 2 nights at the hospital. You know, again, I was a young guy, 20 years old or so, and I had all these veterans around me. And this guy comes walking through the hospital. And imagine, if you will, I'm laying there, my overalls, sheetrock mud, paint, my hard hats, beat up, paint all over it. And this guy comes walking through in this tweed jacket, you know, with the patches like the British guys do. He had on a hard hat that didn't have a scratch or any paint on it or anything. And he had a set of plans underneath his arm and a briefcase. And he came walking through. And, you know, here I am laying down, comatose, tired, not knowing what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I nudged one of those old guys next to me. I'm like, "Hey, man, who's that?" And he goes, "Oh, that's the engineer." Now, pause. What I would tell you is years later, after I've been in the business, that would have been the architect. But all I heard was engineer. And so I decided I was going to become an engineer from that moment on. And so I began to go to school part-time at one of the community colleges. And it was really a challenge because I neglected my academic skills so badly while I was in high school and junior high school, I had to have a tutor just to help me add and subtract fractions when I went back to community college. And so I was, you know, by God's grace, I was able to not only survive, but really thrive in that world, and spent 2 years, you know, continuing to work construction and going to school part-time. And I was able to get my 2-year degree and transfer to the University of Central Florida in their engineering program. Central Florida back then was on the outskirts of Orlando in the woods. And so again, I got to just indulge in fishing Mosquito Lagoon and Merritt Island, hunting down there, surfing down there, did a lot of mountain biking, a lot of hiking. And it was just just the collision of senses with being outside again, but also now having a clear vision for my life as to what I wanted to do. And so I ended up getting a job as a geotechnical engineer. And, you know, again, looking back, it's fun to kind of trace that pattern, because as a geotechnical engineer, the whole idea is that you're studying the dirt, right? You're studying how you interact with the dirt through construction, through ponds, all of these types of things. And so for the next several years, I would become a geotechnical engineer and really even learn that much more about construction design. But almost I got cabin fever, you could say. I was involved in a very small part of the project, and I had such a desire, because I love construction so much, to be involved in a much larger aspect of it. So I ended up transitioning out of geotechnical engineering into the planning and engineering side of space, you know, space matters. And so now, instead of just working on the foundations and the earthwork, I was beginning to build my repertoire on projects from what it looks like to take a piece of land, identify a use for it, maybe rezone it, entitle it, come up with a plan for it, work with folks to develop that, and then to sell it. But I was doing that as a consultant. So I did that for about 6 years. And then in the early 2000s, two brothers that were some of my best clients, some of the greatest mentors I've ever had, Paul and Jerome Flesher, they convinced me to leave the consulting world of doing the development and come into the real estate development world. And so it was a big decision for my wife and for me, but we decided that we would do it because, again, I had this hunger. I wanted to really understand the breadth and scope of projects. I was super involved in the planning, the construction, and the disposition side of it, but I had never done any business planning or raising of the capital stack. I had never done, you know, any leasing. I'd never done anything beyond just the middle scope of design and permitting. And so back in the early aughts, I went to work with Paul and Jerome, and that's really what launched where I'm at today. And so I'll pause there because that was a really long answer to your question, but I have a lot more to share too. So you can help guide me.
What's so fun is I think one of the first posts that I ever saw about the farm and about your work there was like going out and hunting for a wild boar. And I'm like, wait a second, this is a real estate developer here. This is amazing. Like somebody's actually doing this. And it's fun to hear you tie that in, as well as like what an amazing redemption story, because if you're coming out of school with pretty low academic experience to go into engineering as well as real estate development, I don't think that people understand how numbers intensive this business actually is. And especially on the engineering side, holy smokes. So that's incredible. So Doug, to go in, to take that step from consultant into the partnership, what was really your role going to be, and what were the brothers' roles within that partnership?
Yeah, such a good question. So the brothers' roles at the time, they were 70 and 80 respectively. And they had spent their entire career doing some fantastic projects all up and down the East Coast. And one of them literally got in a fist fight with a bulldozer operator because he knocked down the trees that we were saving. I mean, this is the mentality of this guy. And so their passion was around the integration of development and natural landform. I mean, they were of the same kind of vein coming out of California with Ian McCarg, Design with Nature. And so I just fell in love with that concept because for the first time I understood how that, you know, growing up, you always hear about this tension that exists between development and environmental folks. And it feels like you have to join one team or the other. And I felt like for the first time that I could blend these two worlds and figure out a way to develop what's so critical for folks as a place to live and raise their families. But at the same time, how do we do that in harmony with the natural landform and with nature? And so that was the birth of this new plight that I would be on is really going over with Paul and Jerome. And so at the time they wanted to basically wrap up their careers. And so I told them, I said, look, I'm willing to come over, but I want to work with you guys hand in glove for a couple of years. I want to learn everything that y'all know. And so for the next few years, that's what I did. So just getting the opportunity to hear the stories and to be a part of such monumental legends like that was just absolutely incredible and inspiring for me. And so after a few years, I took over the company as president and CEO, and then ultimately as major owner, and then ran the company for probably about 15 years. And about 3 or 4 years ago, we decided to kind of start wrapping down a lot of the projects that we had together and so forth. But you know, that roughly 15 year span when I worked with them and then ran the company was, I look back and was some of the highlights of my life. I mean, we did such amazing projects. And as an engineer, I understood deeply the design and the execution levels of what it meant to take a piece of property, to survey it, to determine all of the horizontal requirements for it. And it positioned me in a really unique way to have a skill set, I think, that that enables me to do at the farm at Okefenokee maybe what would be challenging for others to do without a team of people.
Yeah. What kind of projects were you doing at that time compared to what the farm is now? Was it more land development? Or was it commercial?
It was very little commercial. I would say some of the larger projects that we did, one of them was one of the largest conservation mitigation banks ever done in the state of Florida. If you're familiar with mitigation banking, that's where you take a land that's basically been neglected, and you audit as best you can using environmental techniques And then through varying construction techniques, whether that's plugging ditches that were dewatering the land, whether it's getting rid of the Chinese tallow, the invasive species that's wiping things out, you go into the land and you basically try and turn the land around to what it would have looked like prior to the Industrial Revolution. And then once you do that, you determine the value of the land afterwards, its ecological value. And then the lift, as it were, between its baseline and its ecological value is the value that we as the conservation-based developer bring to the land. And so we're taking land that was neglected and we're turning it into highly functioning wetlands and uplands that are incredible as it relates to wildlife and everything else, flood mitigation, all of these types of things. So
I got to pause you on that one. I haven't heard of this actually. So you get paid ecological value by companies that are trying to offset, like what's the business model?
So you're absolutely right. So you're determining, first of all, it's a complicated process because you're negotiating with about seven different agencies, from the EPA to Fish and Wildlife, Water Management Districts, Army Corps of Engineers, all of these different federal and regional and state agencies. And you're trying to negotiate a plan, a mitigation plan that makes everybody happy. And then ultimately that plan becomes memorialized in a what's called an MBI, mitigation banking instrument. And in that, it's a roadmap to what we as the owner has to accomplish in order to achieve credits. So think of, you know, you're probably familiar with like carbon credits or, you know, other things like that. These are mitigation credits. So that instrument will ultimately define, okay, you're gonna burn the land, which by the way is incredibly important for lands. People have forgotten that, but forest fires are a healthy tool. We're gonna burn the land, we're gonna plug the ditches, we're gonna take out all the invasive species. And as we do that, more and more credits go to our ledger. And then what will happen within certain basin areas, if people want to do developments and the regulatory agencies recognize that they're gonna have a negative impact in that particular area, they'll have to buy credits from me on a ratio of about 7 to 1. So it's a net benefit to everyone. And then that enables them to move the project forward, provides a financial incentive to me, and you end up with a piece of land that has a conservation easement on it forever and ever. That's going to be a very healthy piece of land.
Well, that's amazing. We have not talked about that on this show. That is really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an important tool because, you know, as another user of these mitigation credits is like the DOTs. So if they're building roads and they've got to go through, you know, some wetlands or a marsh or whatever else, it's important that they have the ability to do that. But we have to make sure that negative occurrence is being offset by an equal or greater than positive occurrence. And the impacts that they have, they're relatively small, often involve isolated wetlands or some portion of a larger wetland, but they're not wiping out these huge systems. So you're taking a lot of small fragment impacts and you're doing those in favor of this huge, what's called regionally significant environmental plan. And so to give you an idea of acreage, the last one that I did was about, it started off at about 6,000 and got to be almost 10,000 acres. So we're talking about huge areas that will be set aside in pristine condition for the rest of eternity because they have a perpetual easement over them. So
who owns the land?
Well, the owner will retain the actual fee simple rights to the land, but there's a conservation easement over that land that prohibits any uses of the land. So what I've done in the past is I've given the ownership over to other nonprofits and stuff in some cases. I mean, different people will do different things with the land, but there's nothing that can ever be done from a development perspective on it because it's got the conservation easement over the top of it.
Wow. And how do you find, like, would you go out and buy the property or would a property owner come to you saying that they wanted to do this? What is that business?
Well, so we could do a whole other podcast on this because there's a lot of strategies associated with it. But the biggest hurdle, the kind of barrier to entry, I mean, you're talking about $1 million minimum just to do the permitting for this. And it never took me less than about 3 years to put one of these together. So we're talking about excruciatingly painful negotiations with regulators, which go on and on. But even before you can get out of the gate to get started, you have to ultimately convince all of the regulators that this tract of land, wherever it is ready and willing to accept a mitigation bank. And so the first step is you've got to make sure that it's of regional significance. And there are varying tests that you go through in order to do that. I won't bog you down with all those. So you can't, it's not like you can just go buy 80 acres, you know, down the street and do this. I mean, it needs to be meaningful. It needs to have been, you know, really majorly neglected. And you need to have a plan to bring it, you know, back up to a standard that meets their expectations. So that's kind of the shape of the criteria for it. But then it's also got to make financial sense, obviously. I mean, we're, after all, this is a regenerative real estate podcast. So there's, you know, people, planet, profit. There has to be a profit associated with it as well. So you have to be able to understand if all of the expenses that you're going to go through, not just on the capital improvement side, but also on the maintenance side, that all of those things are worth whatever you'll be able to achieve on the revenue side. And much of that is what the market will bear as it relates to the sales on those mitigation credits. So there's a lot of knobs that you have to turn in order to make the decision whether you want to move forward or not.
Well, that this is fascinating. I love getting to hear different stories about how people have put it together. Yeah.
And we haven't even started talking about the farm yet.
Oh, I know. But I'm starting to see some glimmers of, like, if it's got to be significant and next to a larger area of conservation or whatnot. I mean, looking at the farm and what you're doing, 705 acres, it looks like it's also fitting that that criteria.
Next to 300,000 acres of the Okefenokee Refuge.
Yeah. So let's actually make that bridge. Like, how do you go from the mitigation into the farm? Like, what's the impetus? How do you start putting that together?
Quick story. I'll be brief. I promise. In early 2007, I was working on a plan down south of St. Augustine. We had a large tract of land, and our philosophy as developers was, we always felt like we didn't, you know, the types of projects that I worked on, they weren't just small projects. They were usually thousands of acres, thousands of homes, but they always had a conservation-based element to them. And so I had come up with this concept down there that we were going to basically construct 40-acre farm tracts, and that I would work with the local farmers, because at the time, I knew nothing about regenerative farming. I knew nothing really at that time yet about the industrial food chain and the propagation of destruction of our soils. So I was thinking in terms of commodity crops, you know, corn, soybean, you know, potatoes, things like that. But nonetheless, I felt like that there were a lot of people that, instead of wanting to look out of their back door at a golf course, I feel like there's a lot of people that would love to look out of their back door at corn, right? Corn popping up in rows, like the old song says. And so I was planning out this project. And then in 2008, this little thing called the Great Recession happened. And from about 2008 to 2012, our worlds pretty much ended. And we were just doing everything we could do to hold on to things. And so as a result of that, I ended up selling that property and not getting a chance to do my farm project. And so with that little small lead in, here we go. So about 3 years ago, as I was selling off all the assets that the Fletcher brothers and I owned, I got a phone call. I'll never forget. I was driving my daughter. I had just moved her into Auburn University, and I was driving back home, and my phone rang, and a guy's name, his name's Jeff Meyer. I looked at my phone. I picked up. I'm like, Jeff, what's up, man? I hadn't talked to you in forever. It had literally been about roughly 20 years since I talked to him. And Jeff had, on one of our projects, installed, I don't know, 1,000 to 2,000 oak trees for me. We planted an oak forest. And Jeff's background has been agriculture, alternative energies. And he had just come back from the West, and he had put together one of the largest wind energy projects in the States. It was about 300,000 acres. And ended up selling it to like GE and some other guys, and had just moved back to town. And while he was gone, he had bought a farm in Folkestone, Georgia. And he said, hey, Doug, he goes, I've got some land out in Folkestone, Georgia, and I think you might be interested in it. It's an organic farm, but I think there's something there that we could do together. And I said, awesome. You know, so we set up a time, and I rode out there. And as I rode around and looked at the form, all of those juices that were flowing in me to do the last project, along with, what I didn't mention was, during the Great Recession, I bumped into an author named Michael Pollan, who wrote the book Omnivore's Dilemma. And it changed my attitude and my mind about the industrial food chain. You know, first thing I did is I went out and bought chickens from my backyard. And so I've always had chickens and everything else. And so as I'm walking around, I've now collected, you know, the better part of 15 years of understanding what regenerative agriculture is. And so we're walking around and I'm just getting more and more excited. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, it can't just be me. You know, I know that there's a lot of people, especially coming out of COVID. I talk to young people. I talk to, you know, doesn't matter their age. People are increasingly wanting to understand, you know, where their food comes from. And then even more back to my idea in 2007, I just think that people love agriculture and more specifically, I think people love farms. I think they like to be on farms. I think that people realize more than ever that we're all dopamine addicts, that we've all been accustomed to living in a bubble of air conditioning and heater. You know, we're free from the elements. We're, you know, no bugs are biting us, no snakes are after us. Like, we've built these luxurious prisons of life that most of us live in. And I think a lot of people, you know, like in the movie The Matrix, it's like they're seeing through it for the first time. And so I've got people that have never had any experience with farming, but know that they love the setting. They know that they want to interact with a natural landform. They know that they want to be a part of where their food comes from and know where their food comes from. And so anyways, it was through this vision and through this excitement that Jeff and I put together an idea that, look, there's got to be 250 other people, really 248 because it's Jeff and me, 248 other people that could get excited about owning a farm. And so the idea would be, hey, we'll take the 700 acres, we'll develop in small villages, you know, 25 cabins here, 25 cabins here, all in different settings. We'll develop all of these cabins, and then the people that live in those cabins will all collectively own the farm, and then we'll be able to diversify the funds such that it's affordable for everyone to be able to live there. And even more, by the way, for the people that don't want to get their hands dirty, they don't have to. We have an entire farm team. We got about 25 people working there now that take care of our farm. And all you have to do is pay your monthly fee and you can get your hands dirty. You don't have to get your hands dirty. You can go, you know, pick up your eggs or not. I mean, it's all completely up to you. So I'm going to pause there because I'm all over the place. I need you to reel me in, Neil.
I love it. I'm just like, I'm bristling because I think that we see the world in a really similar way of like, what do people really want? And,
right.
And I think that, you know, we call it breaking bread. Like that's how community comes together.
Yeah.
And this great turning of reckoning around industrial agriculture. And, I think a lot of people that they're feeling that like, we want to be well,
right.
And we want to be in community.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about how you go, like you've got 705 acres and you're talking right. About building in clusters.
Correct. Yeah. Which is so important from a sustainable standpoint, right?
Not a popular design concept in the development arena as a whole.
Sure,
I think it is if you're really keyed into that. But
yeah. Is
that something that you had been doing before, or is that really particular towards the farm and laying this out? Like, it's really helpful, I would imagine, to have a civil engineering background.
Your observations are from my perspective right on. Cluster development is something that I've been passionate about for a really long time. And the reason why is, you know, historically, as we think about the suburbs and as we think about sprawl development, you think about larger lots. In order to do so, you're building a lot more infrastructure. And so in my judgment, I love the idea of building in smaller areas in favor of preserving larger areas. And so now you're not only preserving larger areas, but you're also being strategic on the way that those larger areas connect to one another, because it's not enough just to have an isolated area, But biology thrives on diversity. So you need a mix of both wetlands and uplands. And then another area of wetlands and uplands. And then, by the way, you need an area in case, you know, we have a lot of rain or we have a lot of flood, so that we're developing in areas in ways that we're resilient against these types of things as well. And so by studying all of these things ahead of time before you start development, which everything I know I learned from Ian McCard's book, Design with Nature, it's really about studying the native landform and then inventorying all of the important things, the wetlands, the uplands, the habitat for the animals, the areas of cultural significance, the flowways, you know, all of these things in the case of the farm, the agricultural areas. And so my design process has always been to inventory all of these things. And then they used to have these things called vellums. And you may remember from elementary school, the teacher would lay it up on the projector and it was a clear sheet of paper and she could write on top of it. And it would project up on the wall. Well, this idea of a vellum is like a clear sheet of paper that you can print on. So the concept is you inventory all of these areas and you prioritize them. So let me take an example. Let's say animal habitat. Well, on this tract of land, one person may say 100% of it's animal habitat. But the reality of it is, are there some areas that are critical? There are some areas that are maybe medium scale, and there's some lower areas of inhabitants. And so what we'll do is we'll prioritize it into three buckets: highest priority, medium priority, and low probability. And then we'll take all of those vellums and begin to lay them on top of each other. And then what happens is the land begins to speak. The land says, hey, you need to stay out of this area. You need to stay out of this area. And then you begin to develop a plan based upon where you have the least amount of impact on the native landform as possible. And then you connect those areas with infrastructure as necessary, these little small clusters. And so that's really the way I've always kind of approached development. And the same thing is true at the farm at Okefenokee.
Wow. So this is amazing that you also have the engineering background. For a large project like this, I think the thing that really can trip a lot of people up is sewer and wastewater. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that with a large parcel where you're also clustering? Is there a municipal sewer? Are you doing septic?
Or? Yeah, well, it's a really good question. In a perfect world, I'm a fan of community septic system. Unfortunately, with where we're located, we don't have an outfall that we could get permitted through the state. And so what I had to do was work with a local guy to come up with a system. It's called the Elgin system, and it's a higher level of clarification of the gray water and all of the waste that's coming out of the cabins. And we use those. So it's like an individual septic tank, but it's more environmentally friendly than it is normally. And as over time, we're working with the DNR and with the EPD in order to try to identify some areas where we can do community sewer. But so far, we haven't been successful in getting that permitted. What I did do, though, is I went through the state and we permitted our own water treatment plant. So we have two deep 550-foot aquifer-based wells, and we have a chlorine plant and everything. So we have underground water to all of the cabins on the farm. And then hopefully one day we'll be able to do sewer as well, but currently we use the Elgin system.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And so with the farm, are you going off a playbook where you're doing the horizontal development and creating the paper lots and selling them, or are you actually going vertical and building the cabins?
Yeah. I love your questions. I feel like we may be talking for a really long time. So to answer your first question, I really struggled with this because I've put together lots of, as we talked about before, very large projects, formulated lots of, you know, whether they're DRIs or CDDs or homeowners associations. And as I looked at the zoning category that we would use for the farm, my first inclination was to want to use basically like a horizontal condominium structure. Unfortunately, while raising the money, we have a really good lender out of Birmingham, Protective Life Insurance Company. They wanted to add some sustainable based projects to their portfolio, but one of the restrictions that they had inside of their documents was that we couldn't do basically a horizontal condominium type structure. So it really forced me into using a traditional fee simple plat, and that was a real challenge because to do the clustering the way that I did, and then I had to elongate the lots and make them more narrow, because the setting that I was going for, I wanted no one to even realize that they had a lot line, first of all, because we want it to feel free flowing. The first setting is on a pasture, and I didn't want people to be thinking they had fences. So there's, you know, there's no grasses, there's no irrigation. It's all native grasses out there in and around the cabins themselves. But I had to use some pretty peculiar shapes for the Fee Simple lots. But to answer your first question, it is a Fee Simple paper lot. We sell that lot to the buyer. And when I first underwrote this deal, my plan was to, like we historically do, to sell the lots and then to have people bring in a custom builder and build their cabins for them. The challenge is that access to vendors and subcontractors and other suppliers, you know, has been limited, and consequently prices are through the roof as it relates to building. I'm telling you probably something you already know. The only way for me to then offer a cabin to my buyers at what I felt like was a reasonable price required that I go ahead and do all the general contracting for the cabins as well. So we as a company are almost entirely vertically integrated. We do all the surveying, all the engineering, all the horizontal site development, and all the vertical construction within the farm at Okie Finokie.
And so when you say a reasonable price, what is the price range of these cabins? And yeah. And with that as well, are you looking for residents that are going to be living there full time, or are they cabins where it's, let me get out of the city and visit my cabin on the weekend?
Yeah. Yeah. More than anything, we wanted to invite like-minded people to come and be a part of what we're doing. And then however old they were, wherever they were position wise in life, and whatever expectations they had as far as living, not living, or vacationing, or, you know, second home. And so I would tell you the type of people that have ended up coming aboard, for the most part, span the gamut. There is a disproportionately larger demographic that's, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, but that's not to say we don't have several young families as well. And I would tell you, as far as like, you know, living there, we have a few families that are planning to live there full time, but the vast majority of the people see this as a place to come and spend extended periods of time and then go back to their primary house. And as a result of that, one of the things I've learned over the years working with Paul and Jerome is, you know, anytime you want to create a really vibrant place, you need to have what we call body heat, right? Like, you never want to go somewhere, be by yourself. And so in order to combat the fact that there may be people that come and go from the farm at Okie Finokie, and at times there may not be a lot of people there, we've created a management program so that these people can put their cabins into and under our care. And then we can bring in other like-minded people that are excited about the concept, and they can come and stay and they can participate. More than anything, we want to have people there, we want to have people engaged, and we want to have people, you know, learning and enjoying. So that's kind of the way, yeah, I think about who's there. You also asked about like the pricing and stuff. And so the first phase that I built is largely sold out now. I would say that the average price of the lot was roughly $175,000. It, you know, some of them were less than that, some of them were more than that, but on average, that's about where it was. And then as far as building, in order to incentivize people to come into the first phase and join what we're doing, I offered them that what I would do is I would basically build their cabin at cost plus 5% as long as they built within the first year. And so that's what we're doing right now. And I would tell you that my cost, basically the cabins that we're building out there, generally run around $300 a square foot. So we build a 1,200 square foot. So, you know, that's mid 300,000s. So with the lot, that puts you in right there above $500,000 for the 1,200-foot cabin. For the next cabin up, which is 1,800 square foot, you're in somewhere around $600,000 to $700,000. And then for the 2,500 square foot cabin, you're anywhere from $750,000 to $1 million, depending upon how it's appointed. So,
Doug, cost plus 5%, you're the cheapest general contractor
in the country. I know. Well, that was the point of the endeavor, is to really help people, you know, get over the threshold that, hey, we want to do this. And for me as a developer, you know, I didn't go into this to be a builder. I went into this to bring people along on the journey. And so if that program incentivizes people to come in and go ahead and start building, that was the intent of what we were trying to accomplish.
Hmm. How have you gotten the word out about this? What's the marketing effort look like? Is it word of mouth of the people that have already purchased their lots?
For the most part, I would describe it as word of mouth. Some of the people that then brought their friends along learned about it through some of our social media campaign. I call it a campaign. I didn't have social media until about 150 days ago, 200 days ago. So I don't know that it's a campaign, but it's really just about sharing our story. And then I think it resonates with people. We do have now a few videos that were more professionally done, but most of the stuff is me out chasing wild hogs and cooking things for dinner that I just foraged off the farm. And so on one hand, I think it's kind of hokey, but then on the other hand, most of the people love it. I mean, they see the authenticity. They feel the exhilaration of what it would be like to actually be living off the land out there. And so, that has been some of our marketing effort. We've done some marketing with Mother Earth News, which is one of our partners. We've had a few news stories in local papers. The local news came out last week or the week before, and I did a tour with them. And then I'm going to be in the studio in about 2 weeks. And so, there's some minor stuff, but I'll be honest with you, it's nothing. It's not anything major. It's very localized to our area. But what I think is beginning to happen, and I think what will happen is, people are hearing about it further and further out because I'm beginning to get more and more phone calls and emails. And even for people that may not be in a position to move or to buy right now, I hear this overwhelming excitement in people's voices about what it is that we're doing and how they want to be a part of something like this. And again, this may be it for everybody, or everybody can't be here, but there's something out there. I mean, there's a movement out there, and I know we're on the tip end of the spear, which can be a great thing or a really bad thing. But I'm really excited because there's a movement out there and there's momentum out there. And so we're just, we're trying to be a light out there. We're trying to show other people what we're doing and how we're doing it. And also recognizing that we don't always do the best job either. I share that with people all the time. Like, we're learning. We're kind of making it up as we go. And fortunately, the people that live out there and the people that have kind of joined with us, and invested financially and invested their lives, most of them understand that and are excited to be a part of something new like this.
Yeah. I mean, this is why we even started the podcast. Was there's no playbook. Yeah. We wanted to do projects like this. There are a smattering of people around the country and the world that have put them together, and they are the first ones to say, like, don't do this. We screwed up here, which I love more than, look at these pretty pictures and
right.
This is amazing, because that's how I see a lot of marketing of these agrihoods or conservation communities, of like, it's the farm lifestyle light.
Right.
And it's more about the house and the clean lines than right. It is about the community and the agriculture side.
Well
and
said.
That's what I think was really attracting me towards what you're putting out, was it's like, wow, not only is here's a developer that is like rolling up his sleeves and living in the community, which is something that really speaks to just, believing in that vision. Mm-hmm. But it positioning this community is like, look, it's agriculture, not farm light.
Yeah. it's so funny you mentioned that. I love your observations. And I don't get this a lot, but every once in a while, someone will come out there and, we'll be walking around or, around, and they'll say, just, does it get really hot out here? Or sometimes they'll say, are there bugs? And, pick your question. And I always smile and I tell them, I'm like, look, you're out in the wild. This is nature. Embrace it. If you want to be in air conditioning, you can go get back in your car, or you can go to your house or whatever else. But you have to come to grips with the fact that nature can be tough. And you can only really experience beauty if you've also experienced the challenges and the tension out of it. And so I tell people, I say, look, yeah, it gets hot out here, man. You get dirty. you sweat, sometimes there's bugs, but you know, that lemonade at the end of the day, sitting on the porch, tastes a whole lot better when you've worked for it than it did if you were in there playing video games, not getting eaten up by bugs with the air conditioning on. And so I, you know, my challenge to a lot of people is, you know, just embrace the natural world. Stop trying to protect yourself so much. Just get out there and get in it and get your hands dirty, sweat, get scared. Those things are exhilarating.
Doug does night walks in the alligator fields.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's true. So true.
No, I think you're spot on of just like how what we're all craving, you know, or yeah. I don't want to say all of us.
Right. I know what you mean.
I know what people are craving is just, you know, something real that is not
something real. Yeah.
Experiencing it through the screen.
Yeah. One of the other things that I wanted to just hit on, and you touched on it a couple of times, but I was very careful, especially in this first phase, to set up the trajectory of the lifestyle for the Farmadoki Finoki. I was very careful on the siting of the cabins as it related to the common area spaces, and more specifically, our huge vegetable and fruit gardens along with the citrus grove. And I positioned everything because I believe really good site planning from a scale perspective and from an orientation perspective can create an experience. And so I wanted our cabins to be located proximate to all of the agriculture to force interaction with community, because I think we're all learning your physical health exercising, although that's a huge piece of it. It's not just about what we eat, but it's also about, you know, our community as well, being involved in the community and feeling a part of a community and having those interactions with other people. I mean, that's a critical part of being healthy. And so, you know, we long to have a place out here where we create those opportunities for people who maybe already know folks or maybe who don't, so that they'll run into them as they're picking their fruit, as they're going to classes, as they're doing other things, because that's such an important part of the site planning.
I want to take a quick opportunity before we continue this episode to talk about the work we are doing at Latitude Regenerative Real Estate. We see real estate as a catalyst for regeneration where we can change the way that we inhabit the planet. The hard part, though, is that real estate is complex and it requires specialized knowledge in areas around design and planning, capital and investment, and community engagement and construction. That's why at Latitude, our work goes to serve those that seek to create legacy projects that strengthen communities and develop ecological resilience. If you are needing help putting together a project like this and could use an experienced and dynamic development and sales team, we hope that you'll reach out to us at chooselatitude.com. Okay, let's get back into the episode. Yeah, and I really want to understand what the feeling is, as well as the geography.
Right.
Like the Okefenokee is a place.
Yeah.
That has ecological significance.
And so I guess how
I would love to come into this part of the conversation is, what is the experience that people have visiting, living from the design that might not be overt to a layman, but to you, of like, what, how do you pick out these elements and then infuse them in so that you can create the kind of experience that you're really going for?
Yeah, let me start broad and then I'll narrow in. The location of the farm at Okefenokee is congruent to the Okefenokee National Refuge. And for those of you guys who may not know, the refuge is in the final stages of being named a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So what that means is they've come in and over the last more than 10 years, they've studied it and made the determination that this is of ecological importance, critical ecological importance. And so our federal government has funded that. And so, you know, that's going to bring in all kinds of education. It's going to bring in all kinds of ecotourism. And the town of Folkston and the town of Waycross, but we're in the town of Folkston, is proximate to the Okefenokee. And so, you know, when I think about that town, it's like in many ways a little town that time passed by because it's not on the interstate. It was on one of those old highways. And when the interstate system of highways came, it took all the traffic off of it. And so since the 70s, Folkston has kind of just been stuck in time. And so, you know, the first thing I would tell you is when people come to visit, they fall in love with the town because the town that's proximate to us is still got a small town feel. The old mayor, Dixie, has a sandwich shop there that I always send people to. She makes her sandwiches and soups homemade every day. And all of the people that live in the town, you know, they know each other and they're so excited about the farm at Okie Finokie because one of the things I think that we got right, and we don't get everything right, like I told you before, but one of the things I think we got right is we're really honoring a tradition that this area has embraced forever, which is agriculture and done also in a way that we think is authentic to the area. And so a lot of times for me and for many of your listeners who are in the development world, you immediately get a bad rap as a developer before even people will listen to what you're doing. And I'm so thankful that the leaders of and the town leaders, the commission, everyone else was open to what it was that we're doing. And they've not only embraced it, but they celebrate what we're doing out there as well. And so it's, you know, not only is it fun for people to come to the farm at Okie Finokie, but it's fun to go to the town of Folkston, which is about 8 miles up the road from us as well. And so that's kind of the geographical kind of context of where we're located. We've got the Okie Finokie Refuge immediately to our west, and then we've got the town of Folkston up to our north. And then we've got 705 acres that are just kind of out in the middle of the woods. And for the most part, there's silviculture operations all kind of all around us. And we're really the only farm. And so we really stand out. We have a lot of people that just drive by that never even come, that just love to come see the cows and the windmills and the flowers and, you know, all of the things you think about when you think about an idyllic farm setting. And then some of the other elements that you asked about, Neil, was the that I would want people to understand is, you know, and I'll share the stories that I get from people when they come to visit me. A lot of people are coming from Jacksonville, which is about an hour away. Some people are coming from Atlanta, which is several hours away. Some people Orlando, Tampa, but they're coming in from these larger cities for the most part. And I just regularly get from them, once they start getting near the farm, they're out of the cities and they're driving through these back roads and they've got trees all around them. And they say that their blood pressure just begins to fall. And they're becoming more and more engaged in their surroundings. And then by the time they get to the farm at Okie Finokie, the way I've designed it is their first visual cue is a barn that they see. And I call it the welcome barn. And they come in and there's a gate. This is the farm at Okie Finokie and the welcome barn, the background. And once you come in, you actually drive your vehicle into the barn. So if you're coming there and if you've got whomever with you, your friends, family, you actually drive into the barn and then there are horse stalls all around you. And inside of each of those horse stalls are what I call farm carts, electric golf carts. And so you'll unload your duffel bag or your groceries or whatever else that is into your farm cart that's parked there. And then you'll pull your vehicle out and you'll park your car. And then you never see your car again because all within the farm at Okie Finokie, it's non-vehicular. Everything is accessed only by golf cart, by bicycles, and by pedestrian walking or jogging or something like that. So the other thing I'd have you know is that we purposefully created an environment where we wanted to be peaceful. So, you know, electric golf carts. And then we also wanted to get people out of their automobiles. I mean, as developers, we've studied over the years that the automobile in so many ways has been great, but in so many ways has really ruined our cities because it gets, you know, the central business districts have become gutted because of the suburbs, because of the access to automobiles. And so, you know, I'm not against automobiles, but I think it takes away from the experience and it requires so much more infrastructure in the project. So we just pulled those off the table right in the beginning. So your experience is now on a farm cart or walking or bicycles, and your interaction with the native landform and with the community is so much more authentic through being a part of it as opposed to being stuck inside of your car, you know, with your windows rolled up and you pull in your garage, you don't say hey to your neighbors and you're done. So those are some of the things I would share with you right out of the gate that have been purposefully designed to set the tone of what an experience could be like here on the farm.
So going from the car to the golf cart, you've got clustered cabins. Mm-hmm. Do they have themes? How do you orient within, or and where's the farm in relation to the cabins?
Yeah, I love it. Great question. So the first phase is called the standing gardens, and each phase will have their own welcome barn, because we don't want too much traffic going through the different small clustered little villages, hamlets, whatever you want to call them. But the first one's called the Standing Gardens, and there are 24 cabins located there. And your listeners are developers in some sense, and you understand the idea of density. But a lot of people coming to visit me don't have any paradigm as to what I mean when I talk about density. So the first thing I do is share with them, because they go, wow, we got 24 cabins here. And I say, well, hang on here. In general, you know, typical development, at least in my region, would suggest that you're going to have somewhere around 2.5 to 3 homes per acre when you consider stormwater, master infrastructure, and other things. So the first phase is roughly 100 acres. So normally you would be used to seeing about 250 to 300 homes in this first phase. We have 24. So, and they're clustered on probably no more than 10 acres. And so basically what you have is 1/10 of the area is dedicated to the cabins themselves, which there's common area running through the middle for the gardens. But then the vast majority of the rest of it is all agriculture. It's orchards. So we have a mahaw orchard. We have a vineyard. We have blueberry orchard. We have a blackberry orchard. We have a huge dog park where you can let your dog out and go swim in and off the leash. We also have a commercial kitchen and clubhouse, and that's where like classes take place. So we'll bring in guest chefs and teach people how to do preserves and jams and make kombucha and wine and, you know, all kinds of. So again, it's all about the education and the learning, but that's just the first phase. That one I'm pretty much sold out on. The next one, which I'll be opening up in April of this year, is called the Orchard. And that's the next roughly 100 acres. And there, 90 of that 100 acres is solid olive trees that were planted about 7 years ago. So it's a huge olive orchard. And there we have the infrastructure such that the cabins will be tucked into the olive orchard. So it'll feel almost like you're in Tuscany or something. So you wake up and you look out your windows and you've got olive trees all around you. And so it takes on a very different feel. And then the third area that I'm working on that I hope to open up late this year or early next year is called the pasture. And it's a 40-acre pasture. And the pasture is where we keep a lot of our cows, our pigs, and other things that do a lot of the regenerative activities. And then there we'll have the cabins. We have a perimeter road that goes around that long pasture. And then the concept is you pull in off the perimeter road with your golf cart, and you're looking at the back of your cabin, because the front of your cabin is tucked into the forest edge such that its front porch is just sitting out on the pasture. So you can walk out on your front porch and you can give lettuce to the cows, but the whole setting is that you're actually out on the pasture there. And so those are the three phases that we are largely almost finished with. And then the next phases that we'll be doing, one of them will be equestrian. So we'll have an equestrian component. And the other portion we're looking at doing is a huge rookery, because we have all kinds of migrations of gorgeous birds that come through the Okefenokee. So we're going to build a huge rookery and lagoon system, and then set the cabins on the lagoon system so that their backyards are a dock with an electric boat or a canoe or a kayak on them. So those are just the ways I'm thinking about kind of clustering and organizing the balance of the project over time.
That sounds so cool.
Yeah.
I mean, like really, like this is, I think, the leading edge.
Yeah.
Of the development world.
Yeah.
Of how can development and conservation be mutually symbiotic?
Yeah. Yeah. Your reaction is anybody who comes out, the thing that I don't get is the yeah, but. No one ever says yeah, but. They say, are you kidding me? How in the world can I come to a place like this? And look, again, I'm not saying that what we're doing is for all people, but in general, what we're doing, I think, has a huge appeal and can be replicated in other areas. And I think other people who do it will have the same reaction and excitement and aspiration that we're sensing from the people that come and visit.
Doug, you had touched on the classes and the different things that of the community element. What are the other ways that you're really thinking about bringing people together? And I love that quote that your former partner had about body heat or something like that. How to stimulate that.
I'll never forget it as well. So with my background being in conservation development, I spend a lot of my time working on the developed space. And Jeff's background in being agriculture spends his time working on the gardens and the animals and all of the other stuff. And so, you know, we were talking about earlier about how I was fortunate enough to have a series of experiences that have kind of propelled me to a point where I can do this. I couldn't do it without Jeff because I don't have the agricultural background that he has. And so the same way I have unique gifts, he has a host of unique gifts. And then together, we have a complementary skill sets that we encourage each other and we feed off of each other. So, Jeff and I share responsibilities on the farm. And one of the things we talk a lot about is how can we create events to get people together? This past week, Jeff had gone to Louisiana to see his son, and he brought back the entire back of his pickup truck had oysters in it. So we had a huge community oyster roast at our community center. And we invited, you know, the people of the farm, the workers, the community leaders, and everybody else. And we sat out there for hours on end, shucking oysters and, you know, hanging out and telling stories. And so, you know, it can be as simple as just a small event like that, or it can be Jeff has another restaurant in town. It's an incredible farm to table restaurant. In fact, we supply a lot of their vegetables now, but bringing their chefs out to do some very gourmet type meals. Now, over time, we'll have a restaurant of our own, but, you know, these things take time, obviously. And other things that we do is we have the local wildlife people, like at the Okefenokee. We send people out there all the time to do boat tours to understand about the biology of the swamp. We invite them in to do classes, you know, at our farm at Okefenokee. And so we partner with other people. And then over time, we'll bring other people in because even the people that have places there, I was just talking to, we have a physician who's a member, and his passion is making beer. And so I was like, hey, man, you need to come in and do a class on making beer, because I think a lot of people would really enjoy that. We can have a farm beer. We've partnered with a local distillery. We had 15 barrels, however much are in those whiskey barrels, of honey in those. And now we're taking the honey out to have whiskey honey, and we're making rum out of the sugar cane that we pressed so that we can give that out to all of the members there as well. So one of our objectives through the regenerative farming side of what we're doing, we try to be completely sustainable as an inclusive community. So we've got, you know, fruits, vegetables, oils, sugar. We have protein through the eggs and the catfish. And then if you so choose, you can do protein as an a la carte basis through other animals and so forth. And so, you know, our objective, and again, we're not perfect, but our objective is so that if you live there, you could live entirely off of the farm.
I'm just kind of gobsmacked right now. and that doesn't happen very often of trying to host a podcast where your job is to ask questions, but I'm like really trying to process of that lived experience.
Yeah.
Because it really sounds like quite a partnership that y'all have formed to really think through a lot of these areas. And the thing that's coming up for me is one, I want to move. That sounds amazing. but two, like how do you incorporate the farm? Is it a CSA? Is it a farm stand for the residents? How do you bring that element together?
Yeah. So here's what I share. And again, we're maturing as a community, and this will have to evolve. Right now, at least, there's three levels. The first level is after training, we invite people to come out and pick whatever they need for that day. You know, it's an honor system, but what we don't want to have, and, you know, we don't have people like that now, but over time you could potentially have folks that come out and, you know, they pick a week's worth of ripe tomatoes and then they don't eat them and they go bad on the counter. So what we do is we ask people, hey, pick what you need to eat today and then come tomorrow and pick whatever you need to eat and then so forth and so on. That way there's always ripe things for everyone. So that's, you know, idea number one is you do it yourself. Idea number two is at the end of harvest seasons, there will be, you know, much more bounty that just needs to be picked. Or if we're, you know, with winter greens and stuff, they need to be trimmed all the time so that you're promoting the good plant life. So we'll have a bounty of excess stuff that we'll share with the community if they want it. And then also with that, we're currently supplying those to a restaurant only because we have so much bounty that we can't even eat it all. But over time, we'll supply that to our restaurant. And we're also working with the USDA right now to permit a food kitchen in downtown Folkestone. So we can have like fresh vegetables for folks that are less, you know, have less, that are less fortunate. And then the third one would be, once we do complete the restaurant, which we have plans for, we have plans for like a large lodge, like an old timey lodge you'd see at Yosemite. And then within that, we would have a casual lunch counter, but then next door to it, we'd have a very elegant farm to table restaurant. But we would ultimately supply all the vegetables to the restaurants as kind of that third tier. And so we think through those three layers, that would monopolize the vast majority of what it is that we need to grow and what we're able to grow. And then, you know, to the extent that the members were not receiving the vegetables, the eggs, whatever it may be, then the restaurants would then pay back into the farm owners association for the benefit of having the vegetables, and it'll drive down the cost for the members as well. So they're not like subsidizing a restaurant or anything. So that's kind of the way we think about how we'll utilize the produce and the eggs and so forth.
Let me switch focus just a little bit here. You've been doing this project for 3 years?
About 3 years now. Yep.
How long is this project going to take? This is one of those like really interesting, your life, it sounds quite infused.
Yeah.
With your work.
It is. It is.
With multiple phases. Is this a legacy project that this is it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't want to make any sort of declarations that I have to live by necessarily, but I would tell you the way I think about the farm is there's nothing else that I want to do. I'm in my 50s now, and I never want to retire, but I think realistically, I mean, it's going to take us, you know, maybe not to necessarily develop all the phases, but to finish the building and to do some of the other things we want to do. I mean, we're talking at least another 10 years. And so after getting to live out and do what I'm doing here, I just, unless I'm replicating this somewhere else, I just can't imagine getting the satisfaction that I get out of what I'm doing. Because again, it's like what we talked about in the very beginning. I mean, this is the intersection of my passion and profession. And there's few people I think that get to experience that during their careers. And so I'm not looking to quickly end that.
So looking into a crystal ball here, do you think that this is replicable? Is this something that you would love to see proliferate? Or is it you're creating competition if you're even seeding that into the world? Like, how do you see agri-hoods and conservation communities in the state of affairs?
So, you know, I don't look at others trying to replicate what we do as a bad thing. I think we're far enough out of hit. Number one, I think we're so far out in front of anybody. We're creating the brand, as it were, as to what we're doing. You know, the barrier to entry for a lot of these things is pretty steep, not to mention the least of which, financially, it's been a heavy lift to do what we're doing, but we're able to do it because of my business partners' experiences and my experiences. So we can, you know, we're able to kind of bootstrap it, as it were, and create all of the infrastructure that we've done internally. If you were to try to consult with consultants and contractors and general contractors and designers, like, it would be cost prohibitive to try to do it on the scale of what we're doing. It would require that your density go way up. Like, you would have to really change the methodology of our approach, I think, in order to do it fiscally. So I don't worry about others competing with this. And in fact, I get encouraged. I'm an open book. People, you know, I'm not going to say all the time, but I've had more conversations than I can count now of people who want to either do this, who've had lots of experience, or that are young people that have stumbled onto what we're doing and just call and have a million questions for me. And as you've seen from this, I like to talk. So I'm always happy to share the information. And this is a legacy project for me and for my family, but it's not necessarily our legacy idea. All we're doing is going back to the way things were done 150 years ago. And we're trying to re-understand how that they live so that we might live more like that. So yeah, I get excited about just the concept. I mean, let me give you just a very simple example. I was thinking about this the other day. As we have matured as a country since the Industrial Revolution, but then increasingly since the Great Wars, and I use the word mature in quotes and in a little in slang, we've outsmarted ourselves in so many ways that has had such a negative impact on our health and psyche and well-being. And you know, I'm not one to believe it was malicious or sinister or conspiratory. I just think it was, you know, us trying to be efficient with the way that we were farming, efficient with the way we were growing, efficient with the way that we had, the chemicals that we had, how do we implement those? And so, you know, our lives are now impacted for, you know, from the last 75 years, 100 years of becoming more efficient. And, you know, just a very simple thing like the way that our food is grown, the way that we do it out at the farm at Okefenokee, we use regenerative agriculture as the linchpin. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit we're not perfect at it. We're learning, we're better understanding our internal protocols. We're getting better at figuring out all the processes. But what I do know is the food that we're growing is incredible. And here's what I mean by that. And it's taken me a while because I've had to readjust my palate because I've been so used to buying produce from the supermarket. But all of the food that we're used to eating these days has been genetically modified. It's Roundup ready. It's, you know, we're using a handful of seeds over and over again that Monsanto owns and that, you know, they control. Well, at the farm at Okefenokee, we only use heirloom seeds. Everything that we grow starts as a seed. And we save our seeds from the soil as we grow them each year so that we're propagating better and better strains. And so the food that we grow is out of the soil. And one of the things I've learned from my reading is, you know, as Americans, you know, a lot of the vegetables that we eat are grown hydroponically. And I'm not against hydroponic growing at all. I think at some point it's got its place and maybe we'll have some of it there. But we're lacking in our diets a lot of the minerals that are required by our bodies, the D, the A, the K, all these different things. And when we lack those, we're not bio ready to metabolize all of the nutrients that come from these plants and animals that we're eating. And so one of the cool things that I get so excited about our farm is when I'm eating my greens and my lettuces and my broccoli and my cauliflower and all these other stuff, I'm eating right out of the dirt. I'm getting iron. I'm getting all of these vitamins. Like I'm getting the best you can possibly get. And specifically for me, at least, you know, I've had to kind of relearn how to eat and prepare vegetables because so much of the stuff that I've always bought from the supermarket and elsewhere is, you know, has been genetically modified and it's very sugary. It's, it was picked way before it was ripe and it sat on a train for days to get to us. And, you know, all of those things that characterize our food system is being undone by us out at the farm for at least those folks involved in the project. And so, you know, it's just, it's really, really, really neat. I mean, I feel like personally, I've always had a fairly strict diet in so much that I've always just eaten food, not really a processed food guy. But the level in which I'm consuming vegetables now is just incredible. And the way that it makes me feel, I mean, I've seen a notable increase in my energy, in my stamina, in my sleep. It's just really neat to watch. And so for me, again, living out there, I'm able to kind of document that in my journey as I go. And, you know, you had asked a few minutes ago about, you know, how folks can learn more. You know, a lot of this I've been documenting along the way on Instagram. I previously did not even use social media and my daughters convinced me that it might be fun for others to join along in our journey. And so we have two Instagram accounts. We have the one that's the farm at Okefenokee. And if you just type in the farm at Okefenokee, it'll come up. And there's another one, my personal one, it's under Doug Davis Jr. And the farm, I try to capture all of the projects that we're working on, both agricultural and development. And then on the Doug Davis Jr., I try to chronicle what it's like to live there. And so it's really my journey to experience life on the farm, to experience life with the wild game or the vegetables, how to prepare it, things I'm thinking about. So it's really just a reflection on my journey out there at the farm.
Oh, awesome. Doug, I've never asked this question before, but I think it would be really helpful because you've got a lot of experience that is kind of hard to replicate in a lifetime, you know, just multiple things happening to put you in the right place at the right time. It mm-hmm. sounds like you've mentioned Design with Nature as well as mm-hmm. Michael Pollan's book. Is there any other influences out there, maybe in regenerative agriculture or design, that you really recommend of you know, something that's influenced you to get to this point?
Yeah, I mean, I would say more than anything, I've just been afforded some great opportunities to rub elbows with a lot of great people. I'm a summation of many of folks that have poured into and invested in my life. And so certainly I'm an avid reader, but those two books would be really the pinnacle that represent my journey. I guess another one that I've read more recently that was really good that helped me think through the nuts and the bolts of regenerative agriculture. It's called From Dirt to Soil. And I don't remember the gentleman's name who wrote it, but it's basically his journey of taking a family farm from conventional farming to regenerative agriculture.
That's Gabe Brown.
Yes, that's it. That's it. Yeah. I love to read about everything from, you know, most of what I read is nonfiction. I love to read about Renaissance art. I love to read about cooking. I just anything I can get my hands on, I enjoy reading. My family and I love to travel. And so anytime that I travel, I love to look at great architecture. I love to look at especially small towns. And I'm constantly taking notes and drawing things on scale and things that are impactful to me that then later on I can replicate and maybe something specifically that's a direct ripoff, which is rare, but usually it's a collaboration, a lot of those elements that come together that just help me think through design. So yeah, I mean, I think reading's important, but I think seeing is the most important thing, to be honest with you. And seeing, actively watching, not just observing, but like as you travel, being engaged in maybe why did they do this? How did they do it? And what impact does that have on its community or its surrounding around the location of it? Because, you know, I think I love architecture and, you know, we talked a little bit about scale earlier. I think all of these things really make a community. And even though the vast majority of the people will never realize it, there's something about the setting that really creates the experience. So that would be another thing that I would really push people on is to just get out and observe, but take notes and do it actively. And figure out what you like and what you don't like and why you like it, you know, more than just it's not pretty or it's not whatever else, but is it the scale? Is it the shape? Is it the layout? Is it its, you know, context in the overall settings? You know, kind of write in a journal, really think through it. That's what I've done over the years.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, there's a quote that I know people in our industry love to throw around that we shape buildings and they shape us. But I think it's equally important to talk about how we shape land and land shapes us as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's the really resounding thing that I take away from our conversation today, which is, you know, not only can we create communities like this, and it takes a lot of mindfulness and intentionality, but the reward of that, of being able to see through a legacy project and how we can raise our kids and how we can attune towards health and wellness is just, it's amazing. So I think this was a fantastic conversation. It was
agreed.
Certainly one that I am going to always go back to and really like, there's some conversations that kind of shake me to my core in a good way of like, wow,
right.
This is incredible. So I really appreciate you coming on. I can't wait to visit the farm and see it in IRL and in real life. And in
yeah,
the meantime,
I love that.
I encourage everybody to follow along because the Instagram account for the farm is so fun to watch. And we'll have to do another follow-up whenever you hit another stage.
Yeah, two things I would leave you with. One other thing, not to be preachy, but you know, I would also encourage everyone out there, especially if they have a desire to do something like this. you know, I talk to my kids about this all the time is, you know, nothing that you're going through should ever be wasted, right? Like whether it's a struggle or a time of monotony or whatever else, but, you know, just as you're going through these things, collect them and allow them to become and inform what you're going to do later on. Because at any given time during my career, I'm so fortunate to be where I'm at right now, but there are many a periods that it looked bleak and it looked really dark. And I wondered, you know, how could this ever be good? And yet it was used as good. So I would just encourage everyone out there to craft your story. Don't try to do it like me, but craft your story. And then don't waste what's going on in your life. And then the other thing I would leave you with is if you want to also see beyond the social media, you can reach us at www.okefarm.com. www.okefarm.com. And we'd love to have you join in at whatever level you want to. I'd be happy to chat with y'all individually as well and just really value this opportunity. So thank you for having me, Neil.
If you want to follow our work at Latitude, you can follow us on Instagram at latitude.regenerative.re, and mine is at @IamNeilCollins. We inherently believe in the potential that comes from connecting value-aligned and purpose-driven people together in community. That's why I encourage you to join our mighty network and introduce yourself to the other people working across the globe to advance a more regenerative, resilient, and beautiful world. Here, we want to know what you're working on and what inspires you. Through this platform, you can attend live events, take courses provided by our podcast guest, and create connection with other people and businesses that share your same passion. To join, find the link in our show notes or visit our website at chooselatitude.com. If you'd like to support the show, please share it with your friends and be sure to follow us on your podcast app so that you always have the latest episode downloaded. Another way to support our regenerative field building is to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Positive ratings help attract amazing guests, and they can be the deciding factor for someone else to tune in and listen. And who knows? Maybe this is the kind of motivation that it takes for them to finally decide to align their profession with their sustainable and regenerative values and become a positive force for good within their own community. This show was produced by myself and edited by Anthony Wallace and offered as a part of our work with Latitude Regenerative Real Estate.